CDC is out with updated mask guidance for all of you people that are fully vaccinated. The Jacksonville City Council strips some funding for that proposed Skyway expansion. And the latest on the investigation into the murder of a teenage girl in St. Johns County. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Alyssa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, all of the top stories of the week with our Friday roundtable. It's 549-2937. Give us a call. Then later, how you can experience a brush with nature this weekend at the Jacksonville Arboretum. But first, it's Friday, and here to discuss yet another busy week in the news, we're so excited to welcome Dan Scanlon of the Florida Times-Union. Hi, Dan.
Hey, good morning.
Ann Schindler of First Coast News. Good morning, Ann.
Good morning, Melissa.
Writer-journalist Nikesha Williams is with us. Nikesha, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Good morning, Jacksonville.
And rounding out our foursome, WJCT News reporter Sydney Bowles. Hi, Sydney.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Great to have all of you on this morning. Lots to talk about this week, and we will go to your calls in a moment. The number to join our Friday roundtable, 549-2937. Send those emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. Okay, let's begin with the latest CDC guidance on masks, which is very exciting for millions. On Thursday, the agency issued new rules, as another host likes to say. They say that fully vaccinated adults can safely resume activities indoors or out without any masks or distancing in gatherings large or small. At the same time, Governor Ron DeSantis said this week he will pardon Florida residents who have been charged with violating COVID safety measures like masking and distancing. Now, we haven't had a mask order in Duval County for a while. That said, unofficially, lots of folks have still been masking up when they go into the grocery store or places like that. So let us know your thoughts about this, everyone. Will you quit wearing masks now if you have been? 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And our Facebook page is open. Dan Scanlon, after more than a year of masking up, this is welcome news.
It is welcome news, but I think people are still going to be scared, some people at least, about going into a huge store or something like that and there's no masks. I've been lucky enough to have both shots, so I have been less and less wearing a mask at places, but always feeling guilty in the back of my mind that I should be, because there's still, as I heard on NPR this morning, a slight chance that I could pick it up or transmit it to grandchildren, whatever.
Yeah, that's right. And as I mentioned, Ann Schindler, Duval County has not kept up its mask order, although it was in place for about a year. When you're in Duval County, you see a lot more people masked up, even without the mandate, than you might see if you go up into St. John's or Nassau County. Now, though, we're moving into a new phase.
That's right. I mean, I have been seeing people wearing fewer masks, generally speaking. And I think that they have been feeling freer, kind of like Dan suggests, to, you know, to be around other people and to gather. But, you know, it's funny because Florida is still so different than the rest of the country. We're very accustomed, I think, at this point to seeing people without masks, to seeing people gathered, to seeing people, you know, doing social events. And much of the rest of the country, I think, still kind of stares at Florida like we're the, you know, strange cousin. But, I think that the whole country is going to get more comfortable with this, and the vaccination seems to be working. It's crazy, though, that it's kind of happening in parallel with this terrible outbreak in India. I mean, yeah. Clearly this is a pandemic that is global and very, very dangerous for much of the world. So it's a real contrast.
That's right. And it's a reminder, Nikesha, that, people are still continuing to contract the disease and get hospitalized and die every day in this state. At the same time, the governor said Thursday he's going to pardon anyone in Florida who had been charged for violating safety measures like masking and distancing. He was discussing the case of two gym owners in Florida who face criminal penalties for refusing to enforce social distancing and mask mandates in their gym. What are your thoughts about that?
My thoughts are mixed. I think the people who have gotten vaccinated are probably the people who were more likely to wear a mask in the first place. So now that the CDC is saying that everyone who's been vaccinated can go maskless, I don't think that truly reduces risk, because those who were anti-mask in the beginning may tend to be anti-vax as well. As far as the governor's move to pardon those who violated COVID safety measures, that's his prerogative. I think doing so sends a message that you can defy federal orders and the rule of law and get away with it if you don't agree with it, if you feel like it's infringing on this sense of liberty that you think you're entitled to when there's a global pandemic happening. But, you know, DeSantis is going to do what DeSantis wants to do.
Now, at the same time, Sydney Bowles, the governor banned so-called vaccine passports, banned businesses from requiring customers to be vaccinated against COVID-19. That law goes into effect July 1. A major part of Florida's tourism industry is the cruise business. Norwegian Cruise Lines is threatening to skip Florida ports because of this measure. And we'll have to see how that plays out, too. The, you know, the cruise business is a little smaller in Jacksonville than it is in South Florida. But this is something to watch.
Yeah, I mean, I think in a way, the vaccine passports and the pardons for people charged with violating the COVID safety orders, I think in a way they're both examples of sort of public health issues being turned into part of this political fight. I think, you know, DeSantis going on Fox News and making this part of the wars over, you know, liberty and political correctness and so forth, when in terms of the pardons for folks, very small numbers of people were charged with these guidelines. I think, you know, like the other guest was saying, it's definitely his prerogative to pardon folks. But I think really what's at issue here is these things being turned into political issues. And as we know, DeSantis is likely to run for president. So that's kind of where I'm looking at it from.
Let us know, everyone, your thoughts about this. It's our Friday Media Roundtable with Dan Scanlon, Ann Schindler, Nikesha Williams, Sydney Bowles, and yours truly. The CDC says masks can come off if you've been fully vaccinated. Will you keep wearing your mask? Will you get your vaccine if you haven't already? 549-2937. Eric in Arlington. Good morning, Eric. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday to you. Two things real quick. I think the federal government needs to switch gears. We're, given the politicalization of all this, we're never going to wipe this out like we did polio, et cetera. And so I think what they need to do is just start staying ahead of the variants, and everybody who wants to get boosters yearly, and just everybody that doesn't want to get vaccinated, just I don't think we're ever going to get this done, but I think there's people that just will not get vaccinated. And then secondly, I'm going to continue to wear a mask because I'm not much to look at. And
I don't know about that. I can't see what you look like, Eric, but I'll take your word for
maybe
it.
Maybe if I got a mask on, people might think that, hey, there goes a handsome guy right there. So there you go.
Thanks for that, Eric. Dan Scanlon, I think Eric has a great point in that we may never reach herd immunity in this country. And then it's funny, too. Some people actually have said they like masking up because of the anonymity it gives them. You were at NS Mayport, Dan, this week and got a reminder to wear your mask. Is that right?
Yeah, before we went to see Kurt Busch honoring a Marine who got killed, who will carry the name at a future race on his race car. I walked in with the PIO, and we were told by the restaurant, you got to put your mask on. And then everywhere we went, everybody had masks on, the entire crew of the ship. We toured Kurt Busch himself. It's still there. And I think we'll still find that mandate. Big question is, if you go into a restaurant and they tell you, you probably need to wear it regardless of whether you've had shots or not, how can you prove you've had vaccinations if we don't have the paperwork with us?
That's right. I've got the little card showing that I had both shots. You know, they give you that. Use it when you need to. Again, it's not mandated by law, but it's something that you'll need if you want to travel, probably. So be smart about that, everyone. Tracy in Mandarin. Hi, Tracy. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. You know, wearing mask is a more positive output. I am from India, and last two weeks, 8 of my classmates, all doctors, and I'm a doctor here, they died.
Yeah.
And what happened in New York, what happened in India, I think wearing masks, taking precaution, give you more positive output rather than negative. And, you know, there are different strains of cold, somebody has a strep throat. So you're protected from different too. And I see sometimes, once in a while, somebody will walk in, no, I'm not going to get shot. You don't want to argue with them, but at the same time, you have to protect. So nothing wrong. And one should not think what people think about you if you are wearing a mask. If you start thinking about people, you never move in life. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And I'm so sorry to hear that your classmates have passed away. Ann Schindler, you mentioned what's going on in India, where it's an absolutely nightmarish, horrifying situation with coronavirus right now. So many people dying there. And as Tracy pointed out, wearing masks seasonally in particular is a good idea. We've hardly seen any flu throughout this pandemic because so many people were masking. By the way, here's a tweet from David Cotton at JTA reminding us that masks are still required on public transportation like JTA buses. And we think of what's happening in India as half a world away, but if there's one thing this pandemic has taught us is that it's not half a world away. It can easily happen. Another wave could easily come back over here.
Right. And, you know, the variants are going to play on vulnerabilities. So, you know, it's really going to be incumbent on the U.S. not just trying to get its own population vaccinated, but helping other countries get their vaccines and not, you know, having them sort of hoarded on our shores. It's really, I think, incumbent on us to try to help distribute that and make sure other countries are able to get access. And it really is tragic for Tracy losing her friends. It's so sad. But, I, you know, kind of with Eric on the mask wearing thing, honestly, I feel like I saved a lot of money on lipstick.
Exactly. Yeah. And people can't really see what you're thinking when your mask is on. You can kind of smirk and things like that, and nobody knows.
Well, I found it very frustrating actually covering a jury trial recently for that reason. You know, there's just kind of no way to read the 12 or 14 people are sitting there with their face fully covered.
Yeah,
but,
exactly,
you know,
right.
There has been a lot. I mean, my kids did not get sick this year.
Right.
You know, that's a real thing.
It is. Seasonal mask wearing through the flu season, which other countries have been doing for years. That could be a norm that we see become more common in America. We'll have to see. Anne is on the north side. Hello, Anne. Happy Friday.
Hello.
Anne.
Good morning. Happy Friday. As a parent, I took initiative to become vaccinated as soon as it became available to me. As a New Yorker, native New Yorker, who lost almost 10 people in the span of 6 weeks when the virus began, I have applauded my company who has continued to follow the science, and I'm disheartened that we are putting this big voice out there that says no, masks are not necessary, or that downplays the safety that masks offer. As a vaccinated person, I still wear my mask. It's not for me only. It's for the protection of others. I have a high-risk child. She wears a mask. I will continue to work from home, but my company has put out there that they were looking to allow office space for fully vaccinated people. And I think more companies would be looking to do things like that and let people know that if you're vaccinated, there are safer ways to have community and to get back to community, which if that's what we want to do, we want to do that safely, thoughtfully, and with following the science, not our opinions and not our politics.
Yeah. Thank you for that, Anne.
Thank you.
Such great points, Nikisha. You would think it would be common sense to follow the science, but this has been politicized, as others on this discussion have pointed out.
It absolutely has been politicized, and that's even seen in the numbers of people who say they will not get a vaccination, and those people in those areas and communities tend to lean heavily Republican. But with that said, I don't think that the CDC is not following the science when it comes to saying that if you're vaccinated, you can take your mask off. I think that is very much in line with the science. I think since last year, the CDC has tried to err on the side of caution. For example, the talking about, you know, there's a 10% risk of you transmitting COVID outdoors when the risk is literally like 0.1%. That's not, you know, that those guidelines are a little off. So the CDC erring on the side of caution is great, but it goes back to the thing, to the point where there are so many people who are anti-vax who also are anti-mask. So even if you are fully vaccinated, like the previous caller was, or I am, or Dan is, or whoever is fully vaccinated, you might still want to wear your mask because you don't know those who are walking around with no mask on who also don't have a vaccination card either. And as far as, you know, the vaccine passport, I think it's very necessary that businesses and industries try to protect the people that they're that are going to be in their charge. But again, that goes back to that same through line of thinking that it's anti-liberty and anti-freedom to have a mask or to require somebody to have a vaccine, but then you want to go places. We can't have it both ways. And unfortunately, in this country, people want to have it both ways. And it's just not going to be fair to everyone who's trying to follow the rules and err on the side of caution and get vaccinated and wear a mask and protect themselves and their families.
A listener writes on our Facebook page, I will probably keep masking in the grocery and restaurants, even though I was vaccinated. There are still variants floating around, she says. Let's take one more call on this, and then we'll move on to some other news from the week. Charles on the South Side. Hi, Charles.
Hi. So I work in a retail environment, and my company requires masking in the building.
Mm-hmm.
My problem is we fight and have been fighting customers, you know, to put on their mask. And there's no way for me to tell if they have been double inoculated or single inoculated, depending on whatever is there. And I can just see where this is just going to get really nasty. And, you know, I don't have a choice. It's my company's policy that you have to mask up to be in my store. So, you know, it's as far as a personal standpoint, it's a conundrum because you want to service the customer, and we can make provisions for that. But, you know, it's the belligerence that is out there that is frustrating from a, you know,
sure.
service standpoint.
From the public, yeah. I feel for you, Charles, and I'm sorry to hear that. Thank you for that perspective. Sydney Bowles, you really do have to feel for employees and business owners who deal with the public who might still be keeping mask orders in place in their businesses because they will get more pushback now from their customers.
Yeah, I mean, it would be great if we could live in a world where we would all respect the choices that businesses make and the choice that individuals make to protect themselves and their health. And that's not always the case. People are coming from lots of different perspectives, and it can get really messy. It really can. I think retail workers, food service workers have really had it really, really tough over the past year. So I appreciate the caller's perspective. But I think one thing has become really clear, which is that we've all learned a lot about the lengths that other people will and won't go to protect our community, and we're not all in the same place on that spectrum.
That is the truth. And if you're just tuning in, we're talking about the biggest stories of the week with our Friday Media Roundtable. It's 549-2937 as we move on and talk about another big headline from this week, the Jacksonville City Council voting to strip $132 million from a proposed expansion to the downtown Skyway system. The idea is to completely overhaul the Skyway, and this would be paid for by a proposed 6-cent gas tax increase. So, Dan Scanlon, the council members are looking at amendments to this proposal, which would also be used to fund infrastructure projects across the city. This is a blow to the JTA's plan to bring autonomous vehicles to city streets. We'll have to see how this plays out, but as of right now, the Skyway is getting less money.
The Skyway program will still have the 2.5 mile elevated structure conversion in downtown, and that would imply that the automated vehicles, autonomous vehicles, would still be running along Bay Street. But it would not, the money that is being cut out would now cancel the expansion into Riverside and San Marco, where JTA so desperately wanted to do this after years of testing these UTCs right down the street from your station. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. And the question is, will they find another source for the money? JTA did not appear to fight this at council this week. So maybe they have some potential donors out there that we don't know about.
Right. For people who haven't been following this, the JTA wants to completely overhaul the Skyway into what they call the UTC, or the Ultimate Urban Circulator. These would be autonomous vehicles, driverless cars that you could ride to key nodes around town, to the football stadium, to UF Health, to San Marco and Brooklyn, as Dan said. Now, Ann Schindler, another big proposal that the council members are looking at is to whether to use some of this gas tax money to build the Emerald Trail. That's the proposed 30-mile bicycle and pedestrian trail and park system, a green belt that would go all around the city and connect 14 urban core neighborhoods. That is also a really popular idea.
Yeah. You know, the part of the concern, I think, for council members with this proposal, and Leanne Cumber, who's a big opponent of spending on the Skyway really at all, pointed it out during the Committee of the Whole that they had this week. You know, there was no buy-in at the front end about what are our priorities, what projects are we going to choose to fund. And the Emerald Trail is one of these things that it's been around since the Austin administration. It was supposed to be built, I believe, then called the Emerald Necklace. So we're talking decades that it's, you know, kind of been out there as this great idea that hasn't happened. And it's a worthy project, I think everybody agrees. And yet, is that what the city wants, what the residents most want, when you're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars? And what Cumber said is, look, you know, some of these projects, where did they come from? Why is one of the city's projects going to fund a DOT road repair? Like, why would that be something we want to tax our citizens to pay for? Isn't that a state priority? And, you know, I think a lot of people have looked at the Biden infrastructure proposal and said, well, you know, where's that money? I mean, we've got billions of dollars that are going to be coming into Florida and other states, you know, for infrastructure specifically. Isn't this, you know, maybe something, since this initially was a federal project, that we could get some federal dollars for? And so, you know, it's a little bit of a headache saying, you know, we'll take this money, we'll put it to the Emerald Trail. They're shifting around dollars. And I think for council members and for constituents, it's a little bit like starting, you know, with a priority list that nobody created and then trying to perfect it. It's a tangle. And it obviously took a lot of time at that one meeting for one single amendment to go through out of nine. So yeah, Still a lot of discussion.
Okay. And what about this, Nikisha, council member Leanna Cumber saying, let's just get rid of the Skyway, tear it down, take the hit on the money that it would cost to get rid of it altogether. The JTA is fighting an uphill battle to get their vision for this through. And part of that is a matter of timing. I mean, we've been through this terrible pandemic. We've been through a lot of people losing their jobs. Taxpayers are probably letting their city council members know they don't like the idea of spending hundreds of millions of dollars on this admittedly very innovative and cool transportation project, because they see a hierarchy of needs.
I'm going to start by saying, one, infrastructure is important. Making downtown more accessible to those in urban core neighborhoods who aren't easily able to get downtown, and even to people who live on the outskirts in some of the suburban areas of the city, making downtown a destination to go to and want to spend time in, that is all important. But as Anne said previously, there is not a list of priorities, and there's more than one way to skin a cat. So do we need a Skyway? Maybe, maybe not. Would the ultimate urban circulator do the job of the Skyway if it was the on-the-ground vehicles taking people from Brooklyn to the stadium, to Moshwood and Moose, to the North Bank and all these other places? if that's what it's supposed to do, then let it do that. But there's no vision. And as much as JTA says, okay, this is what we want to do, everybody needs to feel comfortable, council, the taxpayers, and JTA, with whatever the vision is. So if this is not working, go back to the drawing board. Because if this emerald trailed emerald necklace has been decades in the making and we still don't have it, it's not like we don't have the time. We've been talking about upgrading downtown Jacksonville and making it walkable, accessible, pedestrian friendly, bike friendly, all these things since before I lived here and maybe even before I was born. So let's go back to the drawing board and get something that works for everyone.
Yeah. Here's another point of view, that the Skyway has never lived up to its potential, but that this ultimate urban circulator could actually be that game changing piece. Sydney Bowles, that's the argument that's being made, that the JTA is trying to convince the council members of.
Yeah, I mean, I think Nat Ford has struggled a bit to fully explain his vision for this thing. I think the idea of fully autonomous vehicles that are going from this elevated train to ground level is kind of foreign to people. And, you know, I think kind of sounds like buses. If you're just talking about ground level transportation that moves a lot of people, but autonomous and electric, and maybe the technology is there and maybe it's not. I think it's a stretch for people to imagine that, especially when, as Nikisha was saying, there are infrastructure challenges that we can all see that impact our daily lives that feel more immediate to us. Now, of course, Nat Ford says that he wants Jacksonville to be on the cutting edge to prepare for this autonomous electric future, and I think that is a beautiful vision. But Leanne Cumber and other council members have said their constituents aren't buying it. That's not their priority. So I think, you know, Nat Ford may have to wrestle with his vision not being quite where the constituents are.
It's 549-2937. Let us know your thoughts about the gas tax. And by the way, did you have trouble filling up this week? Speaking of gas, Alex at the beaches. Hi, Alex. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. I feel like this JTA thing is completely ludicrous, that's a possibility maybe 10 to 15 years down the road. I mean, there are so many buildings, fantastic historic buildings that have just so much potential that should be focused on, and bringing companies in, restaurants, music, retail, walkable kind of stuff that you see great, like Baltimore. I went up to Baltimore, and that place was just bustling and going at it. We have a very similar geographic like Baltimore, because they're right on the water. Mm-hmm. We have the water. We have the space for boats and all the people who live on the St. John's to take their boats to downtown. And I think the people who are running the show are not focusing on the right things, because I feel like there's a couple nonprofit organizations, maybe just one organization that owns about more than half of downtown that is stopping a lot of progress.
Which organization are you referring to?
Well, if anyone in Jacksonville knows about Jacksonville, that loves Jacksonville, they know exactly who I'm talking about. And so I feel like their little octopus-like tentacles are in places. And so that's just that.
You don't want to say who you're talking about? You don't want to name names?
No, I mean, I feel like you're even part of a problem right now.
Why?
Because you're not even doing actual reporting. I mean, the CDC, they're not even giving proper things, and you're pushing.
All right, Alex. We are reporting what the CDC is recommending. We are reporting what the city council voted on. We are giving information to the public. Erica in Mandarin. Hi, Erica. Go ahead.
Good morning. And I really do appreciate you being on air and letting us all, you know, have our points of view.
Of course, go ahead.
Thank you for that. So my thought is climate change. So every time conversations come about regarding how our taxes are going to be spent, so for instance, sorry, I'm not good at this, but with the Skyway talk, mm-hmm. is it resistant to flooding? Like, what are we doing as a county to make transportation resilient to yeah. things like flooding.
The short answer is not enough, Erica.
And what about the Skyway? Like, it yeah. sounds like it's elevated. So
it yeah, like it is.
This forward would, thinking.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. Is the city being forward thinking enough when it comes to looking at the Skyway as one piece of a larger puzzle in yeah. building a more resilient city? There are efforts going on now looking at that. It's they're way behind the curve at City Hall on this, to be fair, but they are starting to look at that, certainly in this coastal city, which has a lot of inland shoreline, which we know can flood and cause a lot of damage. Yeah. The city needs to be doing a lot more. But I
really elevated transportation.
Yeah, I hear you, Erica, and I really appreciate you making that point. Thank you for that. If you're just tuning in, it's our Friday Media Roundtable as we talk about the biggest stories of the week with Dan Scanlon of the Times Union, Ann Schindler of First Coast News, writer, author, journalist Nakisha Williams, and our own Sydney Bowles of WJCT News. And your calls, it's 549-2937 to join us. Okay, we've been talking about the city council guys, so I want to talk about another story from the week. The Duval County Democratic Party says it will reveal the results of a corruption investigation into their party chairperson, Daniel Henry, later this month. Now, this all began when City Councilmember Garrett Dennis, a Democrat, filed a grievance against Mr. Henry in March. He said Henry held improper meetings about the once-a-decade redistricting effort in this city and said one of those meetings was with City Councilmember Rory Diamond, a Republican. Now, this complaint alleges that Henry improperly colluded with Diamond to fix city council districts in this once-a-decade process. Daniel Henry denies the allegations. He says Diamond approached him, and he was blindsided by this. By the way, Rory Diamond denies all this, too. I have received an internal document, this Daniel Henry grievance report, this process will be made official next week. Basically, they're accusing Daniel Henry of malfeasance, of dereliction of duty, and things like that. Okay, now I want to talk about the bigger picture on this, if we could, because while this is ostensibly about an intra-party spat between some Democrats in Jacksonville, the bigger picture is that this is a county that Joe Biden won in 2020. This is a county undergoing rapid demographic changes. It's becoming more like other large Florida metros. And the allegations being made here are that local Republicans were basically attempting to redraw districts in a manner more favorable to them to keep a Republican majority on the city council. And what this is really about is Randy DeFore, a moderate Republican on the city council. And if these allegations are true, the idea would be to make her less politically viable by the redrawing of these districts and redraw lines in such a way so that it would be harder for Democrats to win. This is fascinating to watch, Ann Schindler. You know, Randy DeFore, in a sense, is sort of like the Liz Cheney of Jacksonville. She's a moderate Republican who's out of step with the boys in her party. She doesn't always toe the party line. She was vocal about the attempt to privatize JEA. The allegation is that the local Republican monoculture wants her gone and that these machinations are a way to make it happen. And while the Democrats are going through a grievance process, what's happening on the other side of the aisle is an attempt to consolidate Republican control by forcing out a moderate Republican woman who doesn't always go along with the mandates of her party. What are your thoughts?
Well, part of my thought is just the setup that requires shows a little bit how deep in the weeds this is. And I don't know to what extent, you know, the narrative that's happening matters to city residents. I think the problem is, as with all redistricting efforts, that it divorces representatives from their district and makes them allied with the party that they represent. And in so doing, it creates this, you know, unnecessary, first of all, unnecessary series of conflicted meetings, you know, that just suck an incredible amount of time and polarize people and, you know, make them less receptive to their districts because they're trying to show their fealty to their party. And I think it's, you know, someday in the future, we're going to see these redistricting efforts privatized and outsourced and, you know, given to some sort of, you know, Pew charitable research nonprofit that can say, like, this is where your district should be. This is the line. This is the fairest way to go, instead of leaving it to a bunch of political hacks to poison, you know, the city council members and say, no, no, you've got to push for this. And we've got to get this block and we've got to get, you know, cut this district so that so-and-so can run and be the anointed one. I mean, it really is a barbaric way to run what is supposed to be sort of a city, you know, a civic, you know, function that city council members serve. And I think it's really destructive. So this, you know, turmoil in the Democratic Party is just kind of, I think, part and parcel of the ugliness that we're going to see as they really drill down on redistricting.
Yeah. The saying that always comes to my mind that political operatives and attorneys who work in this world will always tell you is that redistricting is blood sport. And that is what we are seeing happen right now here in Duval County. Here's an email from a listener. I've been an active Duval County Democratic Executive Committee member since 2005. Daniel Henry made mistakes, but nothing that warrants his ouster. He has been one of the most effective chairs in moving the party forward. He needs rebuke for poor judgment, but not removal. Nakisha Williams, your thoughts.
It's politics, Melissa. I mean, that's all it is. And as you just quoted, redistricting is blood sport, whether we see it at the local level for city council seats, at the state level for state representation, or the national level for congressional seats. This is an issue that always comes up in a way that it is an attempt to disenfranchise communities and voters of color by keeping the districts in a way where there seems to be representation, but the party that is in power never loses their majority and never loses their grip. And so the fact that this is all to try to target one councilwoman who is not rank and file uber conservative Republican is not surprising. It's the same thing that we're going to see come next year with the midterm elections. It's not surprising. So the fact that this infighting within the Duval Democrats is happening, that's a distraction from the bigger picture.
Right.
It's a distraction.
That was the point I was trying to make, which is that, and keep in mind, everyone accused in this whole matter has denied all allegations, but there is certainly a long history in this city and in many other locales where there's a political monoculture of the party that has the upper hand getting the opposition party co-opted in significant ways. And the allegation is that the Republicans were trying to co-opt Daniel Henry, throw him a bone in exchange for his help in consolidating their power. That has been a long-term dynamic when it comes to what you're saying, Nakisha, ostensibly giving African Americans representation on local and state and federal bodies, but in effect drawing the lines so that they are not on an equal playing field. Terry in Arlington. Hi, Terry. Go ahead, Terry.
Hello?
Go ahead, Terry.
Hello. This is Terry Bork. And my comment is basically I do think the Republicans are going to be trying the districts as much as they can to keep them in control because the demographics of Jacksonville is changing so much that we have a situation where they will not be able to be in control of the city unless they do through redistricting and draw districts that are very favorable to them and keep the African American community, particularly in minority, and not have a chance to have a lot of power in the city.
Terry, thanks for that. Sydney Bowles, you've been covering this story as well. And the demographic changes in Duval are a part of this whole story.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is playing out at the national level as well, that redistricting has traditionally been about Democrats and Republicans, but as our political parties become increasingly demographically different, where we have the Republican Party being predominantly white, predominantly Christian, predominantly male, and the Democratic Party being more diverse, younger, more urban, I think we are seeing that the consequences of doing redistricting the way that we do it continues to amplify the ways in which African Americans and other people of color are disenfranchised in the system that we've built.
One more big story to get to before we wrap things up. It involves the murder of a teenage girl in St. Johns County. The state attorney's office for the Seventh Circuit says that prosecuting the killing of Tristan Bailey is their top priority, but they haven't decided yet whether the suspect will be charged as an adult or whether a second-degree murder charge will be updated. They've arrested a 14-year-old boy in the death of the 13-year-old Bailey. She was a student at Patriot Oaks Academy in St. Johns County. Her body was found Sunday night in her Durban Crossing neighborhood. Thousands mourned her death at a vigil on Monday. There's a memorial fund in her memory, even a petition on change.org calling for trying the suspect as an adult. We're not going to name this suspect because he is also a juvenile. Ann Schindler, you've been covering this horrible story. Can you share with us any updates?
Well, you know, they've been pretty close in terms of keeping close, you know, any the findings about the weapon, whether they've recovered it. You know, we know that they did a long dive team session and then they wrapped it up and they found something. So, you know, presumably they found something that they believe is connected to this crime. I think the big story right now is just sort of this unprecedented push by the community to advocate for more intense charges for this juvenile. You know, we've spoken to a number of sources that say that, you know, the phone has just been ringing off the hook at the state attorney's office down in St. Johns County, that they have never seen this level of activism. And I think part of it is this is a teen victim and, you know, teenagers are not only increasingly, you know, socially active on social media, but are also increasingly activist thinkers. And so they've been, you know, circulating a petition that's got well over 200,000 signatures that would pressure the state attorney to direct file, basically charge as an adult, which would have much more significant penalties. So
right. That's
kind of an interesting phenomenon surrounding this tragedy.
Dan Scanlon, in January, a circuit judge sentenced a teen to 45 years in prison for first degree murder in this circuit. In 1999, a teenager named Josh Phillips was found guilty of killing 8-year-old Maddie Clifton. He is serving a life sentence. These cases are just horrific, and we don't know everything about this homicide yet. We'll continue to learn more, but trying a 14-year-old as an adult is rare.
You know, I was there when the Sheriff Glover came out and told the population, the residents in the Lakewood area way back in the late 1990s, that they had found Maddie Clifton's body stabbed and beaten underneath Phillips's waterbed. I'll never forget that reaction. And since then, there's been so much controversy over charging the young man as that, and he's still in prison. Then there's Christian Fernandez, who pleaded guilty to killing his half-brother back in 2011,
right,
and it got nationwide attention. He ended up getting released as a juvenile at age 19.
Right.
So who knows which way? All I know that this week the state attorney's office said they're still looking into how to charge. They're going to take a deliberate long look at it. But yet we hear that this young lady was stabbed and beaten around the head. So I don't know where to go from here. It's a horrendous nationwide story once again. We'll just have to hope that the prosecutors and defense attorneys work out something that is suitable punishment.
Thanks for that. Before we wrap it up, let's do a quick lightning round. Stories that caught our eye this week. I'll start. The Florida Coastal School of Law in Jacksonville has been dealt a blow by the U.S. Department of Education's Federal Student Aid Office. They announced the law school's application for reinstatement of student federal aid programs has been denied. because they say the school is not meeting its financial responsibility and fiduciary standards. They say for-profit schools often try to take advantage of students. This casts the future of the school into doubt. We'll continue to follow that. Nikisha, what's on your radar?
I'm looking forward to, and it's a ways off, but the Just Like Me gala for the Performers Academy is coming up at the end of July, and they're trying to raise funds for it now. And it's for underserved and underprivileged kids. They go through the family support services, and they learn, you know, how to just better adapt to life as an adult using the arts as a healing way. And this performance kind of caps off their summer camp. So the summer camp is getting ready to start in June. The performance is in July. Okay. So I'm really looking forward to that.
Sydney Bowles.
Something that's been on my mind for the past couple of days is this Supreme Court case on restricting funding for legal aid organizations. That's organizations that rent or that represent low-income people in evictions cases, domestic violence, other kind of civil rulings. It could be a really big deal for the representation that low-income people can get in these civil cases.
Ann Schindler.
Sorry,
no problem. I didn't mean to catch you off guard.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, my mind this week has been kind of on the Karine Brown thing, the reversal last week, and where that's going with the Supreme Court appeal.
Sure,
possibly.
And Dan Scanlon.
Well, a story that I just had pop on Jacksonville.com about Black history in Jacksonville, two unique areas. One, the history of Black families around the Civil War in Mandarin, and then Norman Studios, a silent film studio, where a white man back in the 1920s did really nice Black depictions in silent films of just human beings going about and doing their exciting things. So those will be opening back up soon to the public, and they're getting renovations right now.
Thank you all, Dan, Ann, Nikisha, and Sydney. Thanks so much. Have a great weekend, and we'll be right back.
This week on Science Friday, you may have heard about people paying big bucks for art sold as NFTs. But what exactly are buyers buying, and why are artists so interested?
The people involved, the passion, it's a totally different experience.
The Sci-Art of NFTs on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
This afternoon at 3 here on WJCT News 89.9.
A pipeline hack causes pain at the pump. Tempers flare at a hearing on the insurrection.
Absolutely not. That's ridiculous.
You're ridiculous.
And House Republicans boot one of their own for speaking out about the big lie.
It's a moment where we have to decide as a party, you know, whether we're going to embrace the truth.
It's the Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. It's called A Brush with Nature, a plein air painting event coming up this weekend at one of the city's urban gems. I got a preview on this fun outing you need to take advantage of this weekend when I spoke with Dana Duty, executive director at the Jacksonville Arboretum and Botanical Gardens. Hi, Dana. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Melissa. Thank you for having us today.
It is so great that events are coming back and people are getting together. Tell us about A Brush with Nature. This is such a beautiful event at the Arboretum. What's on tap this year?
Yeah, I'm really excited about it. This is actually the 10th year that this event has been taking place. It started in 2011. So, I mean, it's just gained in popularity over the years. It's a wonderful event where it brings together art and the outdoors. And participating artists from the First Coast Plein Air Painters come out, and they set up at different points around the 120-acre property. And they really capture the beauty and the essence, and then they put it into these really beautiful paintings. And last year, I was just blown away by these masterpieces that they create. And so it's really exciting. You know, people can take their art home. They can purchase some of the art and take it home with them. And they get to describe and interact with the artist as they're painting, which is one of the most exciting parts, I think, because it really teaches people a lot about culture and being out in nature. It's just a really beautiful event.
Yeah, it is. And and it's an opportunity, too, to see what I think is one of the gems of Jacksonville, the Arboretum and Gardens, which is right in the middle of the city, but is this sort of hidden oasis. And you're planting some new botanical gardens there, too, I hear.
Yes, we are working with these nationally acclaimed designers, Trey Fromey from Three Fromey Designs and also Chris Barkley from HDLA. And these designers have designed some of the top botanical gardens in the nation, including Atlanta Botanical Garden, Bock Towers in Florida, and also Chiquit in Nashville, even one in China. So it's really exciting to get to work with these designers. We've already done one of the workshops. And what's really nice about the Arboretum is it's 126 acres. So we have 7 natural trails. And what's great about it is we'll be able to maintain the trails just as they are. So what people really enjoy about the Arboretum, and we've won awards for our trails. So what's really exciting is we get to do these gardens right in the center, which is the lake loop. And we'll be able to put in things like a children's garden, floral display gardens, which will really make Jacksonville a first-in-class destination for tourism. Because I feel like if we can add on to and complement what the Jacksonville Zoo is doing and the Kummer Art Gallery and just add this really other beautiful natural space and add botanical gardens, it's going to, I think, take the gem to a crown jewel. I'm just really excited about it.
Yeah, it sounds beautiful. And, you know, after the last year of stress and worry and loss, getting out and enjoying this beautiful space, I think, will be good for a lot of people, good for the soul.
Yeah, and even, you know, with the event Brush with Nature, last year we had 2,200 people in, you know, 2020, which was remarkable. But it's such a large space that people were comfortable and felt comfortable walking around. I mean, it's a place where people can social distance, but still be able to enjoy. And we're going to have so many great things happening at the event. But, you know, between that and getting the gardens, we're just thrilled.
Mm-hmm. Now,
so many great things coming.
Now, A Brush with Nature is a fundraiser for the Arboretum. It's free, but you do ask for a donation. Can you tell us a little bit more about how people can be part of this?
Sure. It's a $3 admission price. You can pay for it on our website, jacksonvillearboretum.org. We also take Venmo. We have a donation box on the site, so it's a suggested donation of $3. And then at the event, people will be able to we have great parking, so people will be able to come in, get directly to their parking space. When they come in, they'll be able to experience the art demonstrations. And also, we also have children's activities happening from noon to 3 on both days. We'll have live music and food trucks both days as well. We'll have an ice cream truck. And so there's lots of good things going on. And Earthworks is going to be there, who's a really great partner to mm-hmm. the Arboretum.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to be selling some of the plants. So, I mean, right at the entrance, people will be able to come. And also, if they want to get involved with the Arboretum, we'll have a membership tent there as well. So lots of different ways to get engaged. But if they want to learn more about it, our website is jacksonvillearboretum.org.
That's right, jacksonvillearboretum.org. And they are located at 1445 Milco Road in Jacksonville. It's in the Arlington area, the Arboretum and Gardens, right off 295. If you've never been, you really need to get out and enjoy this. It's A Brush with Nature, the 10th annual event, May 15th and 16th at the Jacksonville Arboretum and Gardens. Also, the First Coast Plein Air Painters will be on hand. Come out, buy the artwork that will be, you can see being painted right there in this beautiful setting, and enjoy a real gem of this community. Dana Duty is Executive Director at the Arboretum. Have fun with it, and thanks so much.
Thank you, Melissa. Thank you for your time today.
Get out and enjoy this weekend, everybody, and thanks for listening. Thanks to all of our guests and callers, too, along with producer Heather Schatz, Director Josh Torres, Editorial Director Jessica Palumbo, and Digital Editor Bill Bortsfield. Make sure to join us today at noon for the Florida Roundup. It's our live statewide call-in program rounding up the biggest stories across the Sunshine State this week. That is today at noon across the state. I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great Friday, everybody.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.